Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack. All one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, February 7th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Ecuador to discuss the case of four Afro-Ecuadorian boys who were disappeared, tortured, and murdered by military forces, according to surveillance footage last December. This case, which has been referred to as the Guayaquil Four, has sparked outrage throughout Ecuador and puts a greater spotlight on the issue of institutional racism during what continues to be a turbulent political climate in the country today. And so with us on the show today is Claudia O'Brien Moscoso. She's an organizer with Black Alliance for Peace in the Haiti's Americas team. She has an article in the Black Agenda Report entitled The War on Africans in Ecuador. She joins us on the show today from Lima, Peru. Welcome to the show, Claudia O'Brien Moscoso.
Hi, Oscar. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. So as you heard in my introduction, I referred to the circumstances of this case as four kids being disappeared, tortured, and murdered, because those are the words of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights last January. There's a lot to be discussed in terms of institutional racism, government corruption, an unpopular president in current Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa, declining civil rights, as well as public outrage. But let's begin with the basics of the case, which is four boys between the ages of 11 and 15 were apprehended by the military and were never seen again. And by the way, this was all caught on surveillance video as well. So those are some of the basics. Can you give us more details on what happened on December 8th in Ecuador, Guayaquil, Ecuador?
Yeah, so four young Afro-Ecuadorian boys aged 11 to 15, two of them brothers, Josué and Ismael Arroyo, 15 and 14 years of age, Nehemías Arboleda, 15-year-old, and Stephen Medina, the youngest of the four, 11, were found. Well, first of all, they were playing. It was about 9:30 in the evening. And as most young boys in South America and Latin America and the Caribbean, I'll play football, you know, but unfortunately very close to the port and also like near military base. So since January of last year, Ecuador has been in a state of exception, right? Kind of martial law, if you will, right? And so the response to what has been an uptick in crime, whether it's assassinations, kidnappings, things like this, has been, instead of getting to the root of what those crimes are, right, whether it's alleviation of poverty or more social services, of course, it's never that, right? But it's a retaliatory response that just criminalizes already criminalized communities like Afro-Ecuadorian communities, indigenous communities, and certainly poor working class neighborhoods, right? So Las Malvinas, which is in southern Guayaquil, the largest city in Ecuador, is a very, very poor neighborhood, right? And the predominant population is Afro-Ecuadorian. So you have these four boys that go missing, right? It's assumed that it was the state until a few days later when there was footage that actually came out where it did show that at some point there had been an interaction, right? I believe the words that they had used was contact, right? Just like very neutral terms. The 16 members of the Ecuadorian Air Force had contact with these four young boys. Apparently there had been robbery in the area, right? And of course, it's late at night. They see, you know, young boys, right? They immediately stop and, you know, interrogate them. It's not shown, again, so the details of the case come out in a very interesting manner, timed out very interestingly and on purpose, right? Specifics of the case have come out on Christmas Eve and then on New Year's Eve when the general population is obviously, you know, they're busy with family, right? So in some ways that was used by Interior Minister, the Minister of Defense to just kind of try to clamp down on this case, right? That has sparked outrage in the community. I was there on the 1 month anniversary where there was a commemorative march, a chihuahua, held in honor of the four boys through Las Malvinas, through their community. And a chihuahua is an ancestral African commemorative march and dance.
Yes.
That's practiced in coastal African towns in both Ecuador and Colombia, right? So it was a beautiful ceremony, right? And a lot of what the chihuahua expresses is that it's done specifically for when a child dies, and part of that community's outcry is to say, why did this child die, right? This was an act of injustice. So there was a very large hundreds of people throughout the community. These boys were just beloved, right? You could speak to any of the people that had come out that had known them since they were in their mom's bellies, right? And would say this, they didn't just break these four or really three families apart, because it's four boys, but one brothers. They didn't just tear these three families apart, they tore the whole community apart.
So in addition to the surveillance footage that I mentioned earlier, there's also videotape of how the public responded, as you just mentioned, in remembering these four boys that were slain. There is video of it out there, but it's mostly from the international press and the Spanish-speaking press that has raised awareness to this incident that took place. Very little in English, which is precisely why we're doing this show. Because as I mentioned at the top of the show, last month you published an interview you conducted for the Black Agenda Report with Uriel Castillo, who is the national coordinator of the National Afro-Descendant Ecuadorian Movement, or MANE in its Spanish acronym. Based on your interview, can you explain how Castillo connected the case to some larger issues in relation to the Ecuadorian government's quote-unquote war on drugs? Because you just mentioned a second ago that you described as sort of as a state of exception, mm-hmm. what's currently taking place in Ecuador. And I have to tell you that as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, I'm very familiar with the concept of the state of exception. We've done numerous shows on how Nayib Bukele, who's a big Trump fan, has conducted a state of exception almost 3 years now in El Salvador. And it's no accident that he just happens to be friends with current Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa as well, but I digress. So give us the connection that Uriel Castillo made in your article.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Uriel is the national coordinator for the Afrodescendiente Ecuatoriana Nacional, so MANE. And they are one of the organizations that is in what a structure that was formed after the disappearance and then found out later, you know, extrajudicial killing of these four boys. What was formed was the Solidarity Roundtable for the Guayaquil Four, which includes many Afro-Ecuadorian organizations, not just in Las Malvinas, but throughout Ecuador, in Las Esmeraldas, which is also a predominantly African part of Ecuador, but throughout the country too, that are expressing their solidarity, not just obviously with the families of the boys and the community, but specifically calling out and condemning the role of the government that in this case, right, the over-militarization and the response to crime that one is actually fueled by them themselves, right? They're, you were mentioning my last article with Uriel, but I had another article speaking to Juan Fernando Terran, who's an economic analyst, also from Ecuador, talking about how dollarization in Ecuador has really allowed for what Ecuador has now become, the perfect U.S. puppet narco state that at the top level, and now let's, you know, a reminder that the Noboa family owns one of the ports and is a business exporting.
Really?
Noboa is the son of the wealthiest man in Ecuador, right? And this is how they make their money, right? So very much what you can very much can clearly see that is a narco state now, again, that calls out the hypocrisy of, you know, a country that's ridden with a 500% increase in homicides and violent crimes, and how Ecuador in the UN, again, right, having a perfect puppet state, the U.S. needs it in certain situations. So in the UN, Ecuador, along with the U.S., is pushing for the multinational security support mission in Haiti. Again, another, you know, invasion, not just of the core group, the U.S., Canada, France, right? And the core group also includes Brazil, right, under Lula. But to get back to specifically how MANE and the Solidarity Roundtable and other organizations are seeing what the situation is that this over-militarization targets already criminalized communities that are systematically made poor. So that might revert to whether it's petty crime, what have you, extremely low levels of any sort of economic mobility, any sort of safety in that situation, right? And then another reason, part of why these boys were out so late practicing football, right, is that many in these communities, many, especially young boys, see sports, not unfamiliar with how it is in the internal colonies in the US, right? But they see sports as a way to get out of this extreme poverty, right? And if you look at the Ecuadorian football team, they're almost all Afro-Ecuadorians, right?
Yes, I have noticed in recent years, yeah.
100%, right? And so it's one of the ways, right, that again is, you know, so the last three neoliberal governments have very systematically, very abruptly, if you will, again, I think a 500% increase in homicides, right, is one of the main insane consequences of what sort of reverting from the leftist policies of the Correa government, right? So they had a larger investment in education, in infrastructure, in the state, right, for the public good, and sort of privatizing all these things, right? So taking IMF loans, right? Going, sort of taking recommendations from the IMF and the World Bank, shrinking the state, things, and any response is really just a militaristic response. It's just a police, you know, that kind of a response. I had mentioned it before in an interview with Ajamu Baraka, who's the coordinating chair of Black Alliance for Peace, of which I'm also a member of, And we have been to Ecuador together to, you know, MANE is one of our partner organizations in the region, and we've worked pretty closely with them specifically, not just on this case, but a couple other situations. And this is something that you can see throughout the region, right? This extreme increase in violence that it really is happening almost at the same time that you see over-militarization of the U.S. in the region, right? So SOUTHCOM bases exploding throughout the region. And I write a lot about Peru specifically because I'm based here and I'm also Peruvian, but I think probably in the past almost a year now, there've been pretty consistent mobilizations and organizing around a huge increase in crime wave, but that is facilitated by the state and that it favors them, right? This increase in violence, this increase in over-reliance in neoliberal policies and the state, right? The brute force of the state and over-militarization.
Now, there's actually a name for this increased militarization in Ecuador. So could you explain to people what is Plan Phoenix and how would you measure its relevance to the Guayaquil 4 case? Because, you know, Wiki easily uses the words of Daniel Noboa, the Ecuadorian president, when he refers to what's taking place in Ecuador right now as an internal armed conflict. That, along with many other things, really caught my attention because it's really just a euphemism for war against your own population, internal armed conflict. And Latin American history has proven that in almost every corner of Latin America, from the northernmost point of Guatemala all the way down to the Patagonia and everything in between. But we're not talking about things that happened in the 50s or 60s or various other parts of the 20th century. We're talking about here and now. So Plan Phoenix sounds like internal armed conflict, which again is really just a euphemism against your own population. And we see that we have this particular case of the Guayaquil 4.
Mm-hmm. Right. So as you're mentioning, right, Plan Phoenix is maybe what would have been referred to as Plan Colombia was, you know, a few decades ago, right? And again, I mentioned the interview I had with Juan Fernando Terán. It's a two-part interview, really exhaustive, fascinating. He's an economic analyst, but also historian and really goes through the whole, right, change of how it went from Correa, but even before that to now, right? But Plan Phoenix is essentially the response to this, as you mentioned, this internal armed conflict, right? These cartels, really, and often there are transnational cartels. So the Sinaloa cartel is actually very prevalent in Ecuador, a couple other Mexican cartels, and honestly, throughout the regions, but it's predominantly the Mexican cartels. And at the very local level, they've also taken, right, they put in their mayors, they put in their, like, judges, it's the perfect crime hub, right? As Stefan was mentioning in our interview, where you could see it as just, like, also similar, right, the Panama Papers, right, how you saw that Panama was just the perfect place to do money laundering through Panama, just through this region that very easily could hide a bunch of, well, different crime, right? Whether it's drug export to Europe from these privately owned ports, one of them being, again, the port of the president's family. But also, again, it's just very much, and I think this is maybe a difference between Bukele's plan and this current plan here. Part of it is also they already did, passed and submitted to Congress to essentially handing over the Galapagos Island to the U.S. as a military base, right? But aside from it being a region of extreme just biodiversity, and yeah, exactly. So it's just, aside from just being a biodiversity haven, people also live there, right? But you're going to have a situation where the U.S. essentially has control over this, the islands, as the war in the Pacific Ocean starts, but continues to heat up, and even more so as we keep getting further into the decline of U.S. empire and the rise of BRICS, of China in particular, right? So they are really, and when I say they, it's particularly the U.S., but even more specifically SOUTHCOM and the military structures of the U.S. and NATO, right? So when you have a plan Phoenix that is supposed to be combating organized crime and also just insecurity in general, right? As you say, it really becomes a war against your own people and in quote unquote internal armed conflict, because you see that this level of coordination between these transnational criminal organizations, both at the highest states of government, whether it's with president and the administration, or even just at the most local, you know, level with having your mayors and your judges and as cartel, so you can truly run a country, you see that the government actually benefits from what they say they are combating, right? And instead of combating what is so clearly in front of them, they're going after already impoverished and marginalized communities that are, you know, going for easy prey, essentially, right? So what should be turning, you know, whether it's military force or whatever, resources to combating poverty, to combating drugs, what have you, it really just becomes combating poor African indigenous communities for the sake of what at the broader, at the not just, you know, the national level, but the regional level is really U.S. machinations and U.S. imperialism behind the scenes. Yeah.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I want to go back to the interview you did with Uriel Castillo for the Black Agenda Report, because I actually have a quote here from Uriel Castillo, which is in regards to U.S. influence on the criminalization of Afro communities, which you just mentioned. So Castillo said the following, quote, "Yes, the role of the U.S. is direct, and the 16 military personnel involved in the Guayaquil 4 case are only the last link in the chain. This would not have happened if the American embassy did not approve of this criminality. This is directly involved, and we are finding out if the doctrine and policy that is being applied is not already designed by the United States through its Department of Defense," end quote. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more on Castillo's quote here about U.S. military interest in Ecuador. You sort of answered it to a certain degree already, but yeah, this is what people at the grassroots level on the street are thinking when making this connection between the criminalization of Afro communities in Ecuador with U.S. foreign policy. And it's quite astounding, you know, that people can read between the lines at the grassroots level and look at something that is glaringly obvious to both you and me, except in corporate media.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I remember when I first came back to Lima, I think it was maybe less than a month after the coup against Castillo. And I went to the first day of the national strike here, January 4th, like hearing everyone being like, oh, the U.S. embassy is behind this, U.S. embassy is behind this. I'm like, oh, you know, our people know what's up. But like, as you said, the corporate media is not going to report on that, but they know exactly what's going on, because one, this is the history of U.S. interference in the region, and it's not just in history books, right? The Monroe Doctrine is 201 years old. It has not stopped. It has maybe been tweaked and updated and is getting mask off moment right now under Trump, but it's been there. It's been the same, right? So when Uriel Castillo or the members of Vané or members of the Boyce family know what's going on, they understand that maybe it's not the U.S. embassy saying, hey, there are these four boys in Las Marvinas, go after them, right? But what is already in place there is a system that if there are four or any young boys out at night, right, like, hey, let's stop real quick, let's ask them what's going on, you look suspicious, right? There's already that assumption of criminality, of suspicion, right? And then when you go after communities that are already in extreme dire straits, like economically speaking, what have you, right? It truly is a recipe, as you said, for setting up a war against your own people, right? Because these raids, right, this is part of what happened to the boys, was, you know, what could have been considered just like a standard routine stop, right? Maybe listeners in New York, I'm based in Lima now, but most of the time live in New York, in Brooklyn. listeners there could probably understand things like stop and frisk, right? You don't need a warrant to stop anyone. You don't need any sort of suspicion. You don't even need a warrant to get into someone's home, right? It's just, again, martial law in a lot of ways, right? So you set up already a climate and atmosphere of distrust against military and police personnel that even though they might not necessarily be trained, although these were members of the Ecuadorian Air Force, you know, these are the members of the same Ecuadorian Air Force that have had regular joint military exercises with SOUTHCOM, NATO, and surrounding partners in the region, including some of, you know, the like social democratic governments like Petro, like Lula, right? They all are involved in these, you know, multi-day joint military exercises that train in what they call, what SOUTHCOM calls interoperability, right? So when it comes to fighting transnational criminal organizations, which is one of their top priorities, through land, air, whatever, right? And throughout different parts of the region, they are training back to back to back. Now, why is there so much, you know, not just training, funding, all of these things, right? Again, and this isn't just by the current administration. This is happening under Biden. This is happening under the first Trump administration, under Obama, right? SOUTHCOM has just exploded throughout the region. There are 76 military bases throughout this region. And those are just the ones we know of, right? And I'm sure the number is much, much higher, in fact. So how organizations at the grassroots level or the grassroots are seeing how all this is set up is that they recognize that the government is at war with them. The same institution that should, by international law, protect their right to life has been turned against them for the sake of the Northern Empire, right? So they see a really cruel administration. And I think it was maybe when the case of the boys, which didn't happen right away, took a couple of weeks for it to be made public, and the family and the neighborhood and the community was really making a big deal out of it, right? And it wasn't until organizations, not just in Ecuador, but internationally, really started making a big deal about it. And then a Guardian article came out that eventually then the government did have to respond, right? But it was initially quite a callous response. And in fact, I think there was some trivial thing that Noboa and his wife were trending for because of an outfit you wore. Not entirely sure, but it would just was very like extremely callous, like four young boys just died and you're worried about your tattoos and how good you look at this, you know, fancy dinner. So very, you know, like not at all in touch with the public.
I think international news outlets like The Guardian and many others in the Spanish-speaking world were more astute to the importance of this case, because when I saw the video footage, one of the first things that came to mind for me was the case of Tyree Nichols in Memphis about 2 or 3 years ago, where there was video footage of police officers violently beating up an unarmed man. And it also evokes memories of the Ayotzinapa case in Mexico several years ago of students being disappeared by the state, once again, under the guise of quote-unquote war on drugs. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is why it's gotten more attention in the international press. It's too bad that there isn't more awareness of it in English-speaking media, but we're certainly doing the best of our abilities here on WPFW. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Claudia O'Brien Moscoso, who's an organizer with Black Alliance for Peace in the Haiti/Americas team. Her recent article in the Black Agenda Report is entitled The War on Africans in Ecuador. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Yeah. siento vuelve a ser como ayer. Viento vuelve a ser como ayer, como aquellos días en que yo vivía junto a mi bohío y la madre mía, como aquel entonces tan solo era el niño y en esa pobreza qué feliz yo era. Viento vuelve a ser como ayer para sentir el comienzo de mi vida, el comienzo de mi historia.
That was Chacalone, La Nueva Crema, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the case of the Guayaquil Four, where four Afro-Ecuadorian boys were disappeared, tortured, and murdered by military personnel in Ecuador. And we're speaking with Claudia O'Brien Moscoso, who's an organizer with Black Alliance for Peace in the Haiti/Americas team. Her recent article in the Black Agenda Report is entitled "The War on Africans in Ecuador." So, Claudia, could you describe to us the public outrage against the government and how the community sort of reacted afterwards or sort of remembered the boys? You mentioned probably the second part already, but give us a little bit more details about public outrage, because as you said, it sort of started off slowly initially, but then it grew. And again, there's more news coverage of this in Spanish-speaking media than there is in English, but the footage is out there on YouTube. And one of the things that caught my attention with regards to public outrage, that it's not exclusive to the Afro-Ecuadorian community, that there are people from all walks of Ecuadorian society in Guayaquil, news footage out there, Black, mestizos, and everything in between, united in their public outrage for this. And I wanted to point that out there because we don't want to go beyond this one case of these four boys who were tragically killed. But it speaks to the public discontent towards this current government. So give us more details about public outrage, if you'd like.
Right. This is a tragic case, but one of many of state violence, you know, against the Ecuadorian people, right? Part of the interview with Uriel, he talks about what is considered the decade of forced disappearances in the 90s in Ecuador, right? There were many cases, and in fact, that day, when was it, January 8th, which was the 1 month anniversary in which and the Chihuahua was held in Las Malvinas, that same day, sometime in the late 80s or 90s, there had been a case of two young Colombian cultural workers, singers, I think, that had gone missing, and are another case of very popular case of forced disappearances in Ecuador. So I believe some of the family members came out for the Chihuahua as well, making that connection, right, that this has been a practice of the state for a very, very long time, and not just in Ecuador, but throughout the region, right? And again, we can't discount that this is a region that is completely battered by U.S. interference and intervention. This is one of the tools that the empire uses, right? Forced disappearances, extrajudicial killings, right? So That is why this is a case that can evoke such national outcry. Although, you know, you see that in the streets. When I was there, hundreds of people had come out. There's, you know, over 80 organizations that have signed on, almost all of them, into a support letter that the Solidarity Roundtable drafted. But yeah, I mean, what you might see that in the street, right? But what is seen in, I guess, broader Ecuadorian society is that, and you might see this more on like social media, right? Almost justifying what happened to these boys, right? Like, well, what were they doing out so late, right? Well, maybe it was the family's fault. Like different things that it's just one, just extremely callous, right? And just a complete disregard for their
life. Yeah, so sorry, but
yeah,
we've heard that narrative several times in many cases of police shootings here in the United States. And that sort of points out something here that we need to point out furthermore with regards to U.S. imposing military policy in other parts of Latin America. Currently in Atlanta, Georgia, there's the ongoing struggle with regards to the case of Cop City and the development of this giant police training ground. Also in the state of Georgia is the School of the Americas. Mm-hmm. And what is the School of the Americas but the original Cop City, which has a long history of exporting and training all sorts of military personnel who have committed numerous human rights abuses throughout various parts of Latin America, including Ecuador. So when we discuss the exportation of U.S. military policy in places like Ecuador, that gives you sort of a snapshot of what we're discussing here, but please continue.
Yeah, no, and thank you so much for bringing that up because, I mean, I feel like you were just reading from the Zone of Peace website, but but the Black Alliance for Peace and many partner organizations throughout the region launched the Zone of Peace campaign back in April 4th of 2023, precisely as what you're saying, right? First of all, exactly, right? School of the Americas, the OG Cop City, but also the OG Southcom base, right? And these things are not just interconnected out of, you know, how people say like, oh, our struggles are interconnected, not because of some ethereal feeling, right? That we're all vibing as a people, because of historical material conditions, right? That these things have happened because of objectives that the U.S. empire has laid out and has continued to lay out for the past several decades, right? When you read military documents from Southcom, they're very clear at exactly what it is that they are looking to do in the region, right? Laura Richardson, who was the commander general of Southcom, it's now someone else, a token Black guy, right? They'll throw us, you know, diversity, imperialism, but they won't actually give us sovereignty. But she used to say all the time, and probably still does, right, that the region, our region, The lithium is off the charts, right? The natural resources and the oil in Venezuela, it's all rich. And the Belt and Road Initiative is really encroaching in our backyard, right? They're very clear about what it is that they are doing and the objectives and directives that they're taking, right? So when you see how these tactics are used throughout the region and in similar ways, right? Obviously, there's always differences in conditions and such, but it's a very coordinated plan, right, to encroach the Pacific Ocean, right? Well, to encroach China through the Pacific Ocean, to encroach the lithium triangle, and more particularly Bolivia, right? Because it's still Chile and Argentina are like under, if you're talking about the lithium triangle, are completely under the command of the U.S. But
and to further support your argument, as we have this conversation today, there's this absurd idea from the Trump administration of retaking the Panama Canal. And one of the reasons for that is, or one of the stated objectives for that is to halt or clamp down on China influence in Latin America. But please continue.
Right, exactly. They write the canal that Nicaragua and China are building are a direct threat to U.S. interests, right? When countries in the region nationalize their resources, right, that becomes under the doctrine of full spectrum dominance, which again, this is like military language the U.S. lays out in position papers, whether it's Southcom or different, you know, military structures, but they're very clear about it, right, that the interference of China in the Western Hemisphere is one of their top priorities in stopping. When the proxy war in Ukraine against Russia started, that was another tension point that was being used both in Ecuador and throughout the region, right? Ecuador, in fact, Noboa was like one of the first to say like, well, we have weapons from, you know, Soviet era and Russian military grade weapons we can send to Ukraine. They ended up only having like one military helicopter that was very, very old. So it didn't, but it didn't matter at that point, right? The U.S. had its puppet, its little puppy, right? And on the world stage saying, oh yeah, the U.S. has support, right? Like they're ready. They are going to stop Russia from denying sovereignty to the Ukraine. But, you know, when has NATO ever been really about sovereignty?
Exactly. Oh my goodness. So Obviously, during the course of this conversation, with a story like this, it can be easy to link it to the larger issues that we've discussed, like government corruption and U.S. imperialism to the point of almost deviation. But to keep focus on the Guayaquil Four at the grassroots level, can you tell us about what organizations like MANE and other Afro-Ecuadorian groups plan to do to continue raising awareness of this story? One thing we intend to do on our part here in the Latino Media Collective is to create a link to your article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about the case itself, about stories from the perspectives of people like Uriel Castillo and Afro-Ecuadorian organizations like MANE, and also to raise awareness of the fact that as we have this conversation today, this is still an ongoing case as to who is responsible, who takes responsibility, who's going to pay for the consequences of their actions. But again, at the grassroots level, what are Afro-Ecuadorian groups doing to continue to do their part to raise awareness to this story? Because otherwise, it would disappear without any awareness at all. And such things like these would continue. And I just want to address one more thing before you answer the question, which is that you pointed this out quite a few minutes ago, which is that this form of institutional racism is not exclusive to the Noboa administration. It's not exclusive to this particular case. It's not even exclusive to this particular century. You know what I'm saying? This goes back decades as far as institutional racism is concerned. And that's what organizations like MANE have addressed and pointed out right away as soon as this happened. But please, go ahead.
Yeah, so the organizations on the ground, the families, including the Permanent Committee for Human Rights in Ecuador, and many other Afro-Ecuadorian organizations and community projects on the ground have joined in the Solidarity Roundtable and have been conducting interviews and have been doing teach-ins about this to their bases, right? Have been and are going to continue to mobilize every 8th of the month, right? As another 1 month anniversary of the death of the boys moves on. So the next one is actually coming up later this week on the 8th. So probably, likely another Chihuano and or another press conference a couple of days before, I believe. But again, just continuing to make noise about the case, follow it in terms of through international law, right? Potentially they're going to be, so the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, they're, I guess, talking about or gathering stuff for a case to be brought through there, potentially the UN. But again, right, I think that that's, the courts are one way that victims of this kind of state violence have. It's very rare that you actually get, you know, justice from the, I mean, you're seeing it right now with the ICJ, right? It's 16 months after genocide and there are still war criminals walking free. So I think that what the community, the grassroots organizations, the families are seeing is that, of course, this is a protracted struggle, right? It's, again, this, of course, yes, it is the case about these four boys, but it's also the long history of state violence, of forced disappearances, of a war on poor African people in Ecuador and in the region, right? So they know that really, it's building their bases, right? It's educating their people. It's getting the masses of impoverished, barely struggling to survive Ecuadorians that might not think about the politics of this, but know that, like, dang, my son might not be safe, right? Like, even someone as apolitical as, you know, whoever, right, can really engage with this case, even if it's not from the, like, theoretical, political, like, macroeconomic level, but just on a very human level, that our children are not safe. So then what is the point of this state, right, of this institution that is supposed to safeguard life? If they're not able to do that, what is the point of this?
Exactly. And I want to go back to the comparison I made earlier with this case, with the Tyree Nichols case that took place in Memphis a few years ago. One of the lessons that was drawn there is that there was this one particular police unit called the Scorpion Unit that residents complained about for years of being abusive, physically abusive to local residents in that part of the United States. What this case and the Guayaquil 4 case I would argue is that local residents in Ecuador, in Guayaquil, Ecuador, have to a certain extent pointed out the same thing, which is that this incident, which was caught on video, is actually an example of incidents that have happened numerous times beforehand that had not been caught on video. Right. And this is precisely why this is still an ongoing case, because if it was caught on video one time, then chances are that this has been done several times to the Afro-Ecuadorian community in that part of the world. And so we're just about out of time, and I want to get your final thoughts as to what else people should learn from your article. But before you answer that question, numerous times here on the show, we have mentioned the fact that in Afro-Latino communities in various parts of Latin America and the Caribbean, the importance of oral history being passed down from generation to generation is crucially important, not just for the preservation of education, culture, language, music, arts, but also to record and remember such criminal actions like these that happened by the state, because oftentimes in places like Ecuador, they are not documented nor recorded rightfully or justly. And so those are some of the things that I drew from your article in the Black Agenda Report, which again, we're going to create a link to. But in the 2 minutes that we have left, what else do you hope people learn from this conversation that you had with Uriel Castillo with regards to the Guayaquil 4 case?
Well, firstly, that I think showing solidarity to the family, to the grieving community, right? They've asked to, again, make this case as public as possible. So sharing the information and talking about the case, right, I think is one thing. But as you mentioned, right, there are so many connections, because that's exactly how imperialism works, right? Whether it's in the global south or in the internal colonies of the global north, right? So one of the demands of our Zone of Peace campaign to make these connections between the COP cities, between SOFCOM bases, particularly WINSEC and School of the Americas, right, formerly known as School of the Americas, is that, again, these are the tactics that the U.S. and NATO and the West in general, right, the white supremacist world in general, carry out so that they can have that, you know, full spectrum dominance and complete control over our lands, our people, right, our foods, what have you. So I think that it's also crucial for folks to really understand that this is something that, yes, of course, it's a tragic case that happened in Ecuador. And again, right, all solidarity to the families and the community, and that the struggle is international, because that is the system that we're dealing with, right? We're dealing with imperialism, whether it's internally or externally. We're dealing with colonialism and neocolonialism. And these are the tragic consequences of living in that kind of system, right? So while we don't want the cases of these four boys to just be like another statistic, which is why you're saying, right, that that political project, and I think it's really, it's something that's deeply ingrained in our region, because it's happened decade after decade after decade, right? We have hundreds of thousands, if not more, of disappeared people all over Abya-Yala, all over, right? I sit in Peru, where the internal armed conflict of the 80s has had well over, even close to 1 million disappeared and executed people because they were potential communists, right? So we have here is a war against the people, right? So what do we do when we're at war? We have to fight back, right? So that, I think, is something that the people in Ecuador, the people in Mané, the families would urge folks to, again, uplift their case, but be involved in the struggle, understanding that, you know, the fight to stop the COP city that is coming out in Queens, well, really already there, right? But being expanded in Queens or in Atlanta, or, you know, is the same fight, part and parcel of that same fight as what the parents of these four boys now have to deal with, right? So I think that I would leave it there.
And again, this is still an ongoing case. There's still an ongoing investigation as to who takes responsibility and what are the consequences of their actions. And this case will still continue to be ongoing so long as public outrage points out that which has been glaringly obvious to both you and I, which is institutional corruption, institutional racism, and innocent children being killed as a result. And with that said, we've been speaking with Claudia O'Brien Moscoso, who's an organizer with Black Alliance for Peace in the Haiti/America's team. Her recent article in the Black Agenda Report is entitled "The War on Africans in Ecuador," and we're going to create a link to her article in our Twitter account. But in the meantime, Claudia O'Brien Moscoso, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much, Oscar.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for being on the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Teresa Wersbianska. House Republicans are working overtime to meet President Donald Trump's demand for a big budget package. Speaker Mike Johnson had GOP lawmakers working into the night ahead of a self-imposed Friday deadline to finish up the details. They're eyeing some $3 trillion in tax breaks, massive government program cuts, and a possible extension of the nation's debt limit. This all comes after a lengthy White House meeting Thursday where Trump's message was simple: get it done. The House has blown past its earlier deadline and is now racing Senate Republicans, who are preparing their own package. Senate Republicans are heading late Friday to meet with Trump at his private Mar-a-Lago club in Florida. The UN's top human rights body is holding an urgent session on spiraling violence in eastern Congo, where Rwanda-backed rebels recently captured a major city. Some 3,000 people have been killed since late January. Karen Shamas reports.
The Rwanda-backed rebels, who captured a major city in eastern Congo, have sought to reassure its residents about their safety. The M23 rebel group held a rally at a stadium in Goma on Thursday that was part of the efforts to shore up public support, even though it faces growing international pressure. At the United Nations, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters,
"Silence the guns. Stop the escalation. Respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Democratic Republic of the Congo."
Africa's top public health body, meanwhile, has said the rebellion has disrupted services at a high-security medical lab in Goma, involved in the control and surveillance of infectious diseases such as Mpox and Ebola. I'm Karen Chamas.
The Trump administration is ramping up its crackdown on migrants, and local community activists say they're prepared to oppose the administration's moves. More from Kennedy Quayle.
The Department of Justice, led by newly sworn-in Attorney General Pam Bondi, announced a lawsuit against Chicago, Illinois, early Thursday, citing its sanctuary city laws. The lawsuit claims that sanctuary city laws thwart federal immigration efforts. Border czar Tom Homan spoke to members of the press Thursday. When asked why Chicago was chosen for the lawsuit, Homan said, "Sanctuary cities are sanctuary for criminals. Make that clear."
Every elected mayor, every elected governor, every elected city councilman, you would think they would want their community safe too, and they would want public safety threats removed from their community. That's your number one responsibility, protection communities. Work with us.
Homan also fielded questions regarding ICE raids that took place Wednesday in Colorado that were supposedly leaked to the public. Homeland Security officials of Denver said in a post to X, formerly Twitter, they were targeting over 100 Venezuelan immigrants they accused of being members of the Tren de Aragua gang. Reports say immigration officials were met with empty buildings and protests where participants yelled for anyone still home to not open their doors. No number has been confirmed, but reports say it was far less than the over 100 ICE expected. Homan said the supposed leak will be taken seriously for the safety of immigration officials.
Operational security, the operation was leaked. And again, we're going to hold those people accountable once we find out what those leaks occurred. People are, this isn't a game. When the operations get leaked like that, it puts our officers at great risk. It's already a dangerous job to arrest we know TDA is dangerous. Everybody can agree to that. But when they get a heads up we're coming, it's only a matter of time before our officers are ambushed.
In response to the increase in immigration enforcement activities nationwide, protests have also increased. Wednesday, there were protests across the nation in all 50 states and D.C. In San Francisco, 200 protesters gathered in the Mission District. An unnamed protester told KPFA's Alice Ottoson she was inspired by the large turnout.
"I'm here in opposition to the mass deportations of immigrants. I'm an immigrant myself and came to this country. And we have the right to be here and the right to stay. And I'm excited by the amount of young people and people here today. It's fantastic. There's a big turnout."
Protests are